From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with one of America's most respected independent filmmakers, Jim Jarmusch. His new movie, Broken Flowers, stars Bill Murray. It won the Grand Prix at this year's Cannes Film Festival. The Independent Film Channel is about to premiere a new animated series that satirizes the independent film world. It's called Hopeless Pictures. We'll talk with the writer and director Bob Balaban, and we'll hear from Jonathan Katz, who does the voice of the psychiatrist that most of the characters rely on. Katz was the star of the Comedy Central animated series Dr. Katz, Professional Therapist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jim Jarmusch, is one of the most respected independent filmmakers in America. He wrote and directed such films as Coffee and Cigarettes, Ghost Dog, Dead Man, Down by Law, and Stranger Than Paradise. His new film, Broken Flowers, won the Grand Prix at this year's Cannes Film Festival. It stars Bill Murray as Don Johnston, a man who made a lot of money in the software business and leads a pretty empty life sitting home in front of a big state-of-the-art TV. His latest girlfriend has just walked out on him. But soon he gets a mysterious, unsigned letter from a former lover who claims that Johnston unknowingly fathered a son with her and that this teenage son has left home and may be searching for his father. Don Johnston has no idea which of his exes from that era of his life wrote the letter. His neighbor convinces him to go on a road trip visiting each of the exes who might have written it. In this scene, Murray is visiting a former lover, played by Sharon Stone. They're sitting at the dinner table, along with her seductive teenage daughter, who is named Lolita.
So what, where do you work?
Oh, Mom has her own business, right?
Yeah. Really?
I'm a professional closet organizer.
Come on.
Oh, I organize people's closets. I even do their drawers. I label everything. I get them all organized. I even color coordinate them.
Yeah, and they pay her for that. It's amazing. Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Lolita. I said you could have a taste. No, come on. That's enough of that.
That's not cool.
Lolita. Interesting choice of name, Laura.
What?
Jim Jarmusch told me that the film's premise of tracking down old girlfriends was suggested to him by a couple of friends. I asked if the idea of revisiting his early life by tracking down old girlfriends was a compelling fantasy for him.
No, it's not. In fact, it's pretty foreign to me because I generally don't like looking back. I don't like going into the past. I adamantly refuse to look at my films once they're finished, for example. I've never gone back and looked at them. It's funny, it's not really the elements of the story are not personal to me. The paternity thing is not some driving thing for me. This looking back is not something really in my nature. So it's kind of odd. And it was also very odd for me to start a story with a character that I didn't connect with really at all. And I've never really done that before. Other characters I write, you know, even if they're damaged or twisted in some way, I feel for them. You know, I have some love for them. And Don Johnston, you know, I just could care less. I feel a million miles away from him in the beginning of the story. So it was kind of odd for me. But it did lead me to something interesting. After I finished shooting and I was pretty exhausted, I went straight into the editing with Jay Rabinowitz, who I edit with. And I walked in and said, Jay, you know, I think we have to edit this film backwards and start with the ending because it's a delicate film to build and I designed it so that I don't, for some reason, care for the character in the beginning. So we actually edited the film in reverse and didn't really see it from front to back until like 6 weeks into the cutting.
And what did that do for you, editing it that way?
It helped me find out where the guy was going because it is a kind of a quiet, delicate film the way I see it, and it's kind of accumulative. And it's also one reason I wrote it, you know, thinking of Bill, because I know Bill Murray could pull this off. So it allowed us to find a kind of emotional tone where the film was going to rather than start from the beginning. And, you know, it's very odd. This film, if someone else edited it, it could have been had a very, very different tone. So I was very, very careful about the tone of the film emotionally and the actors' little moments and just kind of, you know, picking the right takes and moments was very, very delicate, more so than other films I've made.
There's a scene where Bill Murray is just sitting still in his living room, and he's playing a Marvin Gaye record.
Yeah.
And we hear the entire song as he basically continues to sit still. Can you talk a little bit about shooting that scene and why you wanted to? I mean, it's what, a 2.5-3 minute song. Nothing happens except Bill Murray continues to sit there. And it's a wonderful film moment, and at the same time, it's a kind of almost anti-film moment because it's so static.
Yeah, it's. I'm glad you mentioned it because in a lot of ways, it's my favorite scene in the film. It's the song "I Want You," Marvin Gaye, and we didn't use the entire song because I think it's 5-6 minutes long, but it's a good minute and a half, 2 minute scene of Bill Murray's character Don Johnston just sitting in his house. He has a bottle of champagne opened, a glass of champagne poured, which he never touches, and it's the you know, this whole trip has been designed for him by his neighbor Winston, played by Jeffrey Wright, to visit these old girlfriends, and he keeps saying, "I'm not doing this. I would never do this." But we kind of see that he's, you know, he's becoming a little bit obsessed or preoccupied, and this scene is kind of his little space where he's really contemplating this thing. And so I didn't want it to say really anything but that. And Bill did such beautifully minimal things with his hands. At one point, he maybe appears to maybe reach for the champagne glass, but decides against it. And he's just kind of drifting around with this very lush kind of romantic sexual music, you know, swirling around him. And I don't know. I like that scene a lot. It's really a kind of insight into his stasis as a character and his past by the music. And I don't know. I was very, really happy with Bill, what he did with very tiny things.
It's scenes like that that make me think of your movies as like poems. And I don't mean that like, oh, it's so poetic. But I mean, in the sense that a lot of your movies are really about tones and moods and moments more than they are about long, complicated narratives.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, you know, and I think of my work when I do think of it, you know, comparing it to books in a bookstore, I really think of my films as sort of slim volumes of poetry in the back of the store rather than like the big bestsellers being displayed in the front, you know, so I do take that as a compliment, and I do hope my films have something poetic rather than prosaic about them. But again, I don't want to go too far analyzing them myself. But, you know, they are sort of cumulative, and small things resonate, hopefully. It's odd to me. Like, I think that Broken Flowers is a kind of sad film, but it has a lot of funny stuff in it, you know. But I don't think of it really as a comedy. And yet audiences are finding it very funny, which is I like very much because the humor in the film isn't the result of, like, gags or big jokes, but of small behavioral, you know, things people do. So I'm really happy that they find it funny. But there's something else in it besides being funny for me. And also, you know, the ending of the film is, it doesn't really wrap things up, and I think it leaves people in a place where they can't quite immediately formalize their reaction, and I also like that a lot.
The movie stars Bill Murray, who was also featured in your previous film, Coffee and Cigarettes. What were the qualities you saw in him that you wanted to work with?
Well, you know, I think he is really one of our finest actors of, you know, he can do things so, I don't know how to put it, you know, he never pushes anything when he's playing, you know, if you don't want him to. And the smallest reactions are so expressive and complete. And it's funny because, you know, people keep saying, oh, well, Bill Murray, you know, now he's gone into this other mode and Rushmore and Lost in Translation and The Life Aquatic and now Broken Flowers. He's, you know, he's looking for this other part of himself. But, you know, I don't really see that. I see that he's been working on that all along. And I know that he came from Second City and he learned to react to things very quickly. And he is very, very observant of other people, and he's very sensitive to other people and what they feel, you know. So I think he's been doing this for quite a while. And what I think is funny is that, you know, maybe younger people will know him more from Wes's films and Sophia's film and my film, and then we'll find out, you know, wait, you mean that's the guy that was in, like, Caddyshack and Meatballs, you know? And that might be part of Bill's master plan. I don't know. But I think he's been, you know, developing this very delicate side of his acting ability for a long time. And I just kind of reduced it maybe even further than some of the previous characters he played and kept him very, very minimal and just let his face and his instincts, you know, guide his reactions as an actor. So he really came out with a beautiful performance.
Now, what about directing him? Were there certain, is directing him different than directing other actors?
Well, directing all actors, it's different for every actor. You know, there's no one way to direct actors, and there's no one way for one director to direct all actors. So you find a way to collaborate with each person that's very different, and they come from different, you know, different procedures. Bill doesn't like to rehearse. He likes to talk about the character. He likes to talk about things that maybe don't even immediately relate to the character but lead us to the character. Bill and I prepared by talking a lot. We took one long walk about 2 or 3 hours through Manhattan at night one night, and that was our biggest collaboration in terms of finding the character. And then on the set, you know, you just have to make Bill... you have to allow him to walk in and have it fresh, you know. And he stayed very close to the dialogue in the script, which was sort of surprising to me because I kept thinking, but don't you want to make it better? Can't you, you know, help me with this dialogue? And often he'd say, no, this is good. I like this. So he stayed pretty close to the dialogue in the script. And but, you know, other actors that he had scenes with, like Jeffrey Wright, who's an amazing actor, he has a very different process. He likes to prepare and go over the scene and the lines. And Bill, you can't do that because that will kill the scene for Bill. So, you know, it's a tricky thing in directing any actor. You know, you're part psychologist, but you're really collaborating with them. So you have to find the way that the two of you can approach the character together. And really, it's way different for every actor.
My guest is Jim Jarmusch. He wrote and directed the new film Broken Flowers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jim Jarmusch, and his new movie is Broken Flowers. Lynn Hirschberg wrote a profile of you recently in the New York Times Magazine, and she described you as the last major, truly independent filmmaker in America. Do you feel that way about yourself?
I don't. I try not to think about myself in that kind of wide perspective. And no, I don't think that way, because my definition of independent is... you know, the originator of the story of the film being its, you know, having control over it creatively. And there are a lot of people who do that. And people are able to do that even in sort of studio conditions. I mean, the Coen brothers and Spike Lee, who are sort of my generation, have been able to do that. And there are a lot of younger directors like Sophia and Wes Anderson and P.T. Anderson and Alexander Payne that I think have final cut over their films or are, you know, completely responsible for them. If so, they are independent to me. So I, you know, I'm not even sure if that's the same definition other people would use, but because I think of myself as an amateur filmmaker in that I do it because I love the form rather than a professional filmmaker that does it as, you know, as my career or for my profession. So I don't know. I'm not quite sure how to react to that. And I kind of live in my own little sphere as far as, you know, where my place in the world, that always seems very strange to me and kind of funny.
Since some of your films are about, changing the subject a little bit, since some of your films are about facing death or facing that life itself can sometimes feel like a void, I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions about death. I know you worked with Nicholas Ray, who's the great director whose films included Rebel Without a Cause and Johnny Guitar. And you worked, I think, as an assistant to him when he had cancer and was facing death. How did he handle it? Like, I'm sure, an idol of yours. What was it like to not only be working with one of the people who you idolized, but who was also dying at the same time?
Well, you know, it was pretty heavy, but the thing is that Nick stayed so full of life until the very end, and there were times in you know, you'd be sitting with him on some afternoon, and he would just suddenly double up and curl up in intense, excruciating pain and couldn't breathe, and he just wanted to be left alone in those periods, and then he'd sort of come back. And then he'd start talking animatedly about whatever it was you were talking about before. And he was so, I don't know, he was so interested in expression on all levels, on all forms. You know, he early on he did a radio show playing rural blues and prison songs and, you know, kind of Alan Lomax recordings. And, you know, he was a friend of Bertolt Brecht, and, you know, he was just interested in so many things. At the same time, I know he used to play tennis in Hollywood with Hollywood moguls, and, you know, he had a very interesting life, but he was very open, and so I don't know. It was hard, and I stayed in his house while he was in the hospital. His wife, Susan, asked me to stay in the house and answer the phone because she would sleep in the hospital, and I'd visit him also a few times in the hospital right up until his death. So it was rough, and yet at the same time somehow really inspiring, you know, to have contact with somebody like that you— I did idolize his work, and I still do.
Are there other people who you knew at the time that they were dying who made an impression on you in terms of like how they faced it?
Well, my grandmother was 99 when she died. She was a big inspiration to me growing up. She was a very feisty woman, a retired school teacher that, you know, made her living by selling antiques out of her basement and stuff like that. And she got me interested in Native culture, in French literature, in certain impressionistic paintings, and, you know, when I was a young teenager. And when she died, I remember on her 99th birthday, my uncle, my mother's twin brother, said, "Wow, next year you're going to be 100. They'll put you in the newspaper, and you might even be on TV." And my grandmother said, "Well, I'll be damn sure to die before that happens." And she did, but she had to kind of starve herself. And her mother had been 101 when she died, my great-grandmother, and she didn't want to be that. She said, "I don't want to be that old." And so she kind of went out, and she starved herself and then had a stroke. And I used to visit her and hold her hand, and she'd look in my eyes, and I knew exactly. She would just said, "I just want to go now," you know? And her body wouldn't even let her. It took a while, and then she did die. But that was also a kind of inspiring death in a way, because she had lived such a full life, but she just adamantly didn't want to be around much longer. So she made her own choice in that way.
Several of your films are just so urban. You're really associated as a filmmaker who's captured like an urban experience. And you've moved to the Catskill Mountains for at least part of the time. You don't live there all the time, but part of the time. Why did you want to spend part of your time in the country?
Well, I like contrasts, and I love cities. I really love cities. They're like lovers you've had or have, and there's so many different qualities to different cities that I really love. But I also love, like, you know, I love the natural landscape, and I really do think that the cycles of nature, you can learn more from them than from most human expression. So I like the balance. I also love how quiet it is. I love being able to read and listen to music and, you know, do write and do things, let my imagination go without all the noise, both literally and figuratively, of the city. It also deepens my appreciation of the city, because when I come back in, then there are a lot of things I want to do that I might not have done if I'd been here. I might just hide out if I stay here. But I also like wild animals and plants and mushroom identification and you know, bird identification. And so there's a lot of things going on out there that give me a lot. You know, sometimes I feel like the city, it gave me so much energy when I was younger that now maybe it's starting to call in its chips. You know, it's starting to take energy from me. So I get a good balance by being kind of isolated in the woods for half the time.
Jim Jarmusch, great to talk with you again. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me back.
Jim Jarmusch wrote and directed the new film Broken Flowers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor Audio Courses, including Masterpieces of Western Music, Classics from the Baroque to the Modern. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On Friday, the Independent Film Channel premieres a new animated series satirizing the independent film world. It's called Hopeless Pictures. Coming up, we talk with writer-producer Bob Balaban, who also co-stars in it, and comic Jonathan Katz, who plays the therapist everyone relies on. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new animated satire about an independent film production company called Hopeless Pictures is about to premiere on the perfect place for such a series, the Independent Film Channel. It's part of IFC's new Friday lineup of programs satirizing the film world. Hopeless Pictures is produced, directed, and written by my guest Bob Balaban, who also does the voice of one of the characters. Balaban has acted in many movies, including the mockumentaries Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, and A Mighty Wind. He produced and co-starred in Robert Altman's film Gosford Park. His new animated series follows Mel Wax, the head of Hopeless Pictures, a production company that made the recent film There Will Come Soft Rains. He desperately wants to make a hit that will make him a real player in Hollywood. Mel Wax is voiced by Michael McKean. His therapist is played by Jonathan Katz, who we'll hear from a little later. Here's Mel Wax and his therapist talking on the phone in the opening scene from Hopeless Pictures.
Dr. Stein.
Speaking.
Buddy.
Hey.
It's Mel Wax. Have you got a minute? I gotta just touch base with you here. Everything's coming apart. I'm getting a very bad vibe from this picture we just previewed. I had a screening last night that if they had stood up in the audience and said, Mel Wax, leave the business, it couldn't have been more specific. I've got a disaster in Zagreb, which gets worse every day. I have an insane Swedish pill-popping director. My wife thinks I'm cheating on her, which, of course, as we both know, I am. I think I covered...
Mel, first of all...
I'm saying it's angst. Called angst.
Slow down for a second because, you know, this is the good news, is that all of your problems are real.
You know, a lot of people have this very idealistic view of what independent films are like. You know, Hollywood, it's cutthroat, it's egotistical, everybody's sleeping with everybody else, and it's all about celebrity. But independent pictures, that's about art. That's not about commerce. But of course, your series Hopeless Pictures is set in the world of independent movies, but everybody is still totally egotistical. Insecure at the same time. They want to make big money. Everybody's sleeping with everybody. But it's just on a smaller level.
I was going to say, independent movies, big Hollywood movies, I guess you sleep with the same amount of people, you
they're
lie to the same
famous.
Amount of people, you just don't make as much money.
Right.
That's all. You don't make as much.
Why did you want to do this series? Now, it's on the Independent Film Channel. I'm not sure if they came to you and said, give us a funny series about independent movies, or whether you wanted to satirize independent films and went to them.
A couple of years ago, the Independent Film Channel did come to me and ask me to design their image campaign, which is a series of commercials that promotes their network that they show on the network. And the goal is, don't make it look like a commercial, which is a fun goal. You know, I like that goal. So I designed for them 5 animated 60-second spots about a movie studio. And this was a movie studio that only made, their motto, their slogan was, no movie is too small or too depressing for us. And we tracked one movie through these 5 commercials. The movie was called Dance with Pain. and truly, once you start satirizing or attempting to satirize this stuff, you start looking around and that's a pretty viable title, as it turns out. And the idea was they had to make a movie that had no entertainment value of any kind and was just absolutely depressing. And in fact, at one point, in the second commercial, they tried to get Susan Sarandon to star in the movie. And I forget what Susan wanted something. I mean, her character wanted something, not Susan. And they decided not to have Susan do the movie and instead hired their cleaning lady to be the lead in the movie because she was really Polish. And the movie took place in Poland. Anyway, I made 5 of these spots, and then the Independent Film Channel came to me about 8 months ago and said, we had such good reaction to the spots, would you turn it into a series?
You play the studio head's inept nephew, who's the head of production, very insecure, with good reason. And why did you give yourself that role?
I thought I should be on the show because I thought I'd be jealous if I weren't on my own show because, I'm an actor too. And, what if it's really successful? I would have lost an opportunity to get a job without auditioning. I'm really mostly the only person on the show who uses a kind of different voice. And I just thought it would be fun. You know, I've always wanted to be a voice on a show and I thought it might be fun to have to be a different character, although I myself am, it's not a huge stretch for me to play an insecure, neurotic Jewish guy from a city somewhere. But the character is a little bit different for me, and I just did it because I thought it would be fun.
Bob Balaban, Jonathan Katz played the role of a psychiatrist on his own series, Dr. Katz, which used to run on Comedy Central. Why did you want to cast him as a psychiatrist in your series?
Well, I was actually on his show once as a patient, and I probably am one of the few patients on the show that benefited from his psychiatric treatment. I thought he was fantastic.
What did he tell you?
I don't know. I think it was just the act of I needed somebody to listen to me, and it just made me feel better when it was over. I thought he was a psychiatrist, to be honest with you. I mean, I know he's a comic and a funny, wonderful guy, but he is so unerring in the things that he says and in the way that he talks. It's very hard to believe he's not a psychiatrist. So when I thought we needed some glue to glue all of us characters together in this Hopeless Pictures thing, I just thought it would be great to have him be the psychiatrist we're all talking to. And because it's California and because we're in the movie business, we are always driving around and we are always in our cars and other places, always on the telephone. So he's a therapist who literally never sees any of us in person. We only talk to him in 2 and 3 minute increments on the telephone. That's, in fact, in one episode, one of the patients has an emergency and ends up in his office, and everybody's very surprised to see each other because they probably have never met before.
You've been in several movies that rely on a lot or a little improvisation, including Best in Show, Mighty Wind, Gosford Park. What's your approach to creating an improvisatory atmosphere for your new series, Hopeless Pictures?
Well, I think you put it, in your question is the answer to me. It's much more about setting up an atmosphere where people feel comfortable, happy, relaxed, focused, and then getting the right people in the room together. And in this case, it's very much about trying to know everybody well enough to know that there are certain situations that some people flourish in and certain combinations of people that will do better than other combinations. It's really as simple and as complicated as that. And when I watch Christopher Guest directing these wonderful special movies that I'm so happy to be a part of, I'm very, very struck by how frequently the best direction is to be quiet and let somebody go on for a while and then swoop down and control things if you need to. A little more of this, let's go not go there, let's start here, let's end there. But Christopher has taught me just a great lesson that I'm always attempting to learn better, which is to shut up a lot, set up a situation, get the right people together, and let them hang out there for a while. Give it time.
You've been on the show several times, and at every point, in every interview that we do together, there's a point in which I ask you to just describe your family history in the industry. So this is that point in this particular interview. So just sum up.
Well, I don't mind it. I'm happy. My dad was born in 1909 in Chicago into a kind of a poor Russian immigrant family that had a little grocery store. It probably was more like a little delicatessen that sold lettuce on the side, basically. 9 people living in a back room, absolutely poverty-stricken, with no hope of anything. But my grandmother was this genius woman who came over and refused to be daunted. So she went to the Nickelodeon, saw a movie, came back and said to the 7 brothers, "We're going in the movie business." Can you imagine, you know, what that was like at that time to be saying this? I mean, it was insane. What could they do? Well, it turned out all the brothers got infatuated, and within 3 years, they had 10 Nickelodeons. Within 10 or 12 years after that, they had 70 theaters throughout the Midwest, mostly in the Chicago area, that were picture palaces. You know, they were designed by an architectural firm of Rap and Rap. They looked like Arabian Nights. They had gargoyles and fountains and ushers that marched with uniforms and prizes that they gave away. The Marx Brothers had some of their earliest beginnings at some of my family's theaters, Balaban and Katz in Chicago. And they showed a lot of great movies. And eventually, Barney, the oldest brother, went and ran Paramount for 35 years. And Katz and Balaban and Katz went and was head of production at MGM for a number of years. And my dad was instrumental in a lot of development in the cable television world. So I've got a lot of roots back there.
So what do you think your uncles and father would find most unrecognizable about the movie industry today?
I think Barney would be very surprised, you know, to realize that movie studios are run like businesses now. I mean, Barney was very businesslike and made, and Paramount did, had wonderful profits, you know, when he was in charge, and he was very cost conscious. But he was also very concerned with the quality of the movies. And as you know, every movie studio had a kind of a profile. You know, MGM was known, you know, big musicals, very romantic things. Paramount did a lot of classic sort of heroes in famous literature. And, you know, they kind of had a little corner on a market. And the reason they had that is that the people who ran these studios actually owned the studios and made movies that appealed to them, starring people that appealed to them. So the largest thing that's different now, and it's the most obvious thing one could say, and yet we don't always think of it this way, there's nobody whose heart is on the line with the making of the movie now. The marketing department is in charge of what gets made. The advertising department has to say, well, what's the one sheet? We can't make this movie. We can't advertise it. And, you know, the movie world is different. It opens on, you live and die on a weekend right now. So the function of movie stars is radically different from the way they had to function in the 30s and the 40s even. But the simplest thing is that movies used to be made by studios that were run by one megalomaniacal, either genius or idiot, I suppose, but who did whatever they wanted because they thought it would be appealing. Now they're run by committees, and it's a very different world.
Well, Bob Balaban, I wish you good luck with the series.
Thanks, Terry. Always good to talk to you.
Bob Balaban produces, directs, writes, and co-stars in the new animated series Hopeless Pictures. It premieres Friday night on the Independent Film Channel. Coming up, we talk with actor and comic Jonathan Katz, who does the voice of the therapist in the series. This is Fresh Air. In the new animated series Hopeless Pictures, Jonathan Katz plays the therapist that many of the characters depend on. Katz co-created and starred in the Comedy Central animated series Dr. Katz Professional Therapist, which won an Emmy and a Peabody Award. He's an actor and comic who has appeared in several films by David Mamet, who Katz first met in college. Katz's evening of comedy, 75 Laughs, will soon be heard on many public radio stations. Here's another scene from Hopeless Pictures. The therapist, played by Katz, is taking a call from Mel Wax, the head of the company Hopeless Pictures. Michael McKean does the voice of Wax.
Hello?
Dr. Stein, Mel Wax.
Hi, Mel.
Hi. Have you got 30 seconds?
I have more than 30 seconds for you.
Oh, thank you.
I have 40 seconds.
The day is getting progressively worse. It turns out that I can't get in to see the doctor about this tooth. The pain is feeling a lot like the pain I have when I think about my mom. And I thought that would go away when she did, but
yeah,
it's only gotten worse.
Why can't he see you? I don't understand that.
Because, and this is the part that really hurts, is because I'm not famous enough.
Oh, that is...
Well, welcome to the real world. Welcome to the real world. I mean, this is like, it's either Nicole Kidman or Mel Wax. What are you going to take? Whose mouth are you going to be in?
I would go with Nicole Kidman.
I know, but it just hurts. So much pain right now.
I mean, you have to learn to love yourself, not because somebody's making your movie, but because...
I wish I could think of another reason.
You're such an improbable therapist, because I think you're probably among the more neurotic people that I've ever met.
Thank you.
What do you think?
I mean, I think you're both right.
Uh-huh.
No, wait, it's just one of you. I'm sorry. No, I think that both of those things are true. I'm an improbable therapist, but I think there's something about the tone of my voice that people find comforting.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up, even though I grew up in New York City, I now live in Newton, Massachusetts, which is the home of therapy. If you go outside, somebody will say you have issues. You know, just, I'm surrounded by real therapists.
You know, I was talking to Bob Balaban, the creator of Hopeless Pictures, in which you play the therapist, and he said, when I asked him why he cast you in this role, of course, one of the reasons was because you played Dr. Katz in your own series, but he said that when he was a guest on your show, Dr. Katz, professional therapist, he found it really helpful to talk to you in your role as therapist, that you he felt you actually helped him.
Oh, that's so sweet. You know, I try to engage, when I did Dr. Katz, I tried to engage my patients as if I were a therapist. Then about 30 seconds into it, I'd come to my senses and saying, oh, I can't really help these people. Maybe I can make them laugh. But, you know, I've been in and out of therapy most of my adult life.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of weeks ago, I went cold turkey because I can't play a bad therapist for the second time in my life and pay a good therapist. It just doesn't seem right. Because, you know, I'm both being with her and doing therapy and I'm researching a role.
So I sometimes never know whether to take you at face value or not, but did you really stop therapy because of the
role?
I did.
I did, you know, plus which she would say things like, if I said to her, I really need to stop doing this, she would say, let's explore that. And that was another $175 to continue the conversation, which is not a lot in the scheme of things, but still, it's, you know, it's kind of like the mafia therapy. They're not willing to let you go that easily.
You have a comedy show that you've been doing, right, called 75 Laughs, An Evening with Jonathan Katz. Let's start with the title, why it's called 75 Laughs.
Well, you know, I, for many years I worked in comedy clubs where I discovered if you are a laugh-a-minute guy, you'll get fired. It's not enough. They want more. So I picked the number 75 laughs because the show is about an hour and 15 minutes long. Is that 75 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
That is a laugh a minute. So I didn't want to promise more than a laugh a minute. And a lot of it wasn't that funny. A lot of it was sort of whimsical. Some of it was kind of melancholy. Some of it was kind of musical, which is also a little melancholy, if you've ever heard me sing. And a lot of it was, you know, had to do with Dr. Katz, had to do with the world of therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I really confuse actual therapy with pretend therapy a lot.
The 75 Laugh show that you do is actually going to be heard sometime soon on many public radio stations.
Right.
But I want to play an excerpt of 75 Laughs.
And, you do whatever you have to do.
And this is a bit that you do about having MS, which you have, which is something I want to talk with you about.
Right.
But first, I want to play this bit.
Okay. When I was first diagnosed, my wife and I went to see a neurologist, and I said to him, Dr. Dawson, what do people do? They find out they have MS. A guy my age, I was 49 at the time, and he said some guys have 10 affairs, and some guys climb Mount Everest. So my wife and I talked it over. And we decided on one affair and three romantic dinners. Because I'm not an outdoorsman.
That's my guest, Jonathan Katz, who is a comic, an actor, and writer. Jonathan, is this the, quote, bright side of MS, that it gives you good material?
Well, you know, I got married, and there was, all of a sudden, I went from having 5 minutes to 20 minutes. I had children, I had a solid half hour, and then I got MS, so I can do an hour now. So, you know, I know it's a disease, but it also happens to be a hook for me, mm-hmm, as a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I had a hook that didn't also come with a disease.
Really?
But I don't. And I think I've told you this, that not only do I have an illness that's become sort of very chic to have right now, but I'm very competitive with other celebrities who have MS. Like Terry Garr, who is a good friend of mine. I said to her recently, I'm going to make you wish you had lupus.
Getting MS for an actor is obviously not a good career move. I mean, it affects so much of your life, and certainly affects your emotion and you know walking and mobility and everything.
Right.
Did you hide it for a while, thinking like you'd have no career if people knew?
Yeah, I did. I did, and I discovered after I was making a TV show in L.A., and it was a very physical job, oddly enough, because it was on the Paramount lot, which is enormous, and I had to cover a lot of territory. I worked with many writers, actors, and I discovered after, it was just a coincidence, September 11th, what we call 9/11, that living with MS is easier than pretending not to have it.
What was so hard about pretending not to have it?
Well, because yeah, I went around being as physical as other people and pretending that I can walk as far as other people, that the heat doesn't bother me, when in fact MS makes you very susceptible to the heat. And then once a week I would have to take this drug, which sort of was keeping the disease at bay, and I would be out of the loop the next day. I'd be loopier than usual. So it was tricky, kind of like an exhausting game of hide-and-go-seek.
How did you figure out how to go public about it? Like, who's the first person you tell?
Well, I'm going to tell my wife tonight, I promise. I guess my wife came to Hollywood one day, and we met with my manager at the time and my lawyer,
mm-hmm.
and they both looked at me very sternly and said, Jonathan, in Hollywood, you're not allowed to be sick or old. So I moved back to Newton, Massachusetts, where both things are encouraged. So, you know, I sort of withdrew from Hollywood because it was, seemed like a harsh kind of reality for a guy with a disability.
Mm-hmm.
And started thinking of ways, and my best friend in show business is this guy, Tom Snyder, with whom I make animated things and radio things, and we started working more intensely on stuff. And he is somebody who, when we went to L.A. to pitch a TV show, an animated show to Fox, I showed up on a little red scooter, a handicapped scooter, and he rented one just to be supportive, even though he doesn't need one. And we showed up at the reception desk, and we said, we're here for handicaps.
You know, it's almost creepy laughing at your jokes. I mean, you're
well,
yeah.
Because there's something of a disability that makes people uncomfortable, and I like to sort of demystify it for people.
My guest is comic and actor Jonathan Katz. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic and actor Jonathan Katz. He co-stars in the new animated series Hopeless Pictures, which premieres Friday night on the Independent Film Channel. One of the things you like to do is improv. And
right.
you do a lot of audio sketches. I mean, I imagine there's a lot of improv on Dr. Katz. I know that there is in the new series that you're doing.
Right.
But, you know, you do a lot of improv within your own shows now. You get somebody from the audience or a comic friend of yours and do a largely improvised sketch together. Why do you like improv so much?
Because I discovered, I guess, somewhere in the mid-90s when I met this guy, John Benjamin, who played my son on Dr. Katz,
mm-hmm.
that I want to enjoy comedy, too. I don't just want to do it for the audience. I mean, and I would get in the booth with this guy, and they would have to carry me out because I was laughing so hard. Because he made me laugh. We kept that laughter in the show. So occasionally you could hear me on the verge of fainting. And then, I guess it's the surprise, because I can see jokes coming a mile away, and I don't mind. And they could be great jokes. My friend who passed away not so long ago, actually so long ago, a guy named Ronnie Shicks, used to tell this joke about therapy. He said, I saw my therapist last week, and I've been seeing the same guy for 12 years, but last week he said something that brought tears to my eyes. No habla inglés. I have to assume I lost you, Terry.
It takes a second for that to register on me.
Yeah, it's okay. Such a good joke, but you know, it's just a joke.
Did I just flunk that one?
Well, you didn't flunk, but you might have to take it again.
The thing I love about your jokes is that, you know, some of them are just like so oblique. It takes me like
and it sneaks up on you from behind
moments.
Almost.
Yeah. I feel like such a failure because I have to like sit here and think through your jokes, and I'm not, you know.
No, that's okay. Listen, this is the.
Is that a good thing? Does that speak well of your jokes that I actually have to think about them before I laugh, and like 30 seconds later I'm laughing?
I think if you had paid to get in, it wouldn't be a good thing. But the fact that we're on the air together, it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. I'm flattered. Because if my jokes were immediately accessible, you wouldn't need me. You'd be talking to someone else.
Of course. how perfectly logical. Well, Jonathan Katz, great to talk with you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Jonathan Katz does the voice of the therapist in the new animated series Hopeless Pictures, which premieres Friday night on the Independent Film Channel. Our thanks to Jay Allison and the people at the public radio website transom.org, where you can hear more work by Jonathan Katz. His evening of comedy, 75 Laughs, will soon be heard on many public radio stations. He also plans to perform the show in New York. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And from Warner's Home Video, presenting Alexander, Director's Cut, introducing Oliver Stone's final cut of his epic film, available on DVD. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
So, come here often? On the next Fresh Air, we look at the new dating scene with the inventors of speed dating and the online match service eHarmony. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new animated satire about an independent film studio called Hopeless Pictures is about to premiere on the perfect place for such a series, the Independent Film Channel. It's part of IFC's new Friday lineup of programs satirizing the film world. Hopeless Pictures is produced, directed, and written by my guest Bob Balaban, who also does the voice of one of the characters. Balaban has acted in many movies, including the mockumentaries Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, and A Mighty Wind. He produced and co-starred in Robert Altman's film Gosford Park. His new animated series follows Mel Wax, the head of Hopeless Pictures. Can I do a pickup there? His new animated series follows Mel Wax, the head of Hopeless Pictures, the company that made the recent film There Will Come Soft Rains. He desperately wants to make a hit that will make him a real player in Hollywood. Mel Wax is played by Michael McKean. His therapist is played by Jonathan Katz, who we'll hear from a little later. Here's Mel Wax and his therapist talking on the phone in the opening scene from Hopeless Pictures. Ready? This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jim Jarmusch, is one of the most respected independent filmmakers in America. He wrote and directed such films as Cigarettes and Coffee, Ghost Dog, Dead Man, Down by Law, and Stranger Than Paradise. His new film, Broken Flowers, won the Grand Prix at this year's Cannes Film Festival. It stars Bill Murray as Don Johnston, a man who made a lot of money in the software business, but leads a pretty empty life, sitting home in front of a big state-of-the-art TV. His latest girlfriend has just walked out on him. But soon he gets a mysterious unsigned letter from a former lover who claims that Johnston unknowingly fathered a son with her and that his teenage son has left home and may be searching for his father. Don Johnston has no idea which of his exes from that era of his life wrote the letter. His neighbor convinces him to go... Don Johnston has no idea which of his exes from that era wrote the letter. Don Johnston has no idea which of his exes from that era of his life wrote the letter. His neighbor convinces him to go on a road trip visiting each of the exes who might have written it. In this scene, Murray is visiting a former lover, played by Sharon Stone. They're sitting at the dinner table, along with her seductive teenage daughter, who is named Lolita. Oh, sure, yeah. In 3, 2, 1. Jim Jarmusch wrote and directed the new film Broken Flowers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We'll be right back.